and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
As we unpackage what happened on Election Day, I'm really excited for this discussion. We're sitting down with a campaign manager who just helped Congressman Matt Cartwright get reelected. The congressman was first elected in 2012. The lines have changed in the district, and the overall politics of Northeast PA have also changed. Now, you may have heard that President Biden's from Northeast PA. If you haven't, well, that's just odd, and this podcast is probably not for you. But for our listeners across Pennsylvania who are familiar with President Biden and are familiar with Pennsylvania politics, I think that the perspective and the approach that our guest has can teach us a lot. In future races, there's going to be a lot of lessons that can be learned from what happened and what this team just pulled off. Mel Atit, welcome to my kitchen table.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us and for what you've been doing in the trenches, like literally deep in the trenches of Northeast PA politics. Have you caught up on sleep?
Yeah, luckily. So again, I think I was telling you this before we started, but a lot easier to catch a lot more restful sleeps when you win than when you don't. So I've been sleeping with a smile on my face since we pulled it off.
When was it official that Congressman Cartwright was it wasn't election night. It took a bit of time. But when did you and the congressman learn that it was officially a win?
So we basically got all the precincts reporting by, if I remember correctly, about midnight. Right. And then it was just math county by county. I think I called Congressman Cartwright at 12:30 and congratulated him on being reelected. And so we obviously respected the process, waited until the AP called the race the next day. And then he spoke. He gave his victory speech. But I think the first indication that I felt pretty good about how things were going is that we got Lackawanna County results, and they were right on par with how he performed. He actually performed slightly better this year than in 2020. And that came in pretty early in the night. So I think that was 8:45 or 9 p.m. Don't quote me on those exact timestamps, but it was right around then. And when we got that first result back, the mood in the room, I was with the congressman and his family, we were feeling pretty optimistic and hopeful at that point. And then as we got more and more results, it became pretty clear that he was going to be on the right side.
All right, good stuff. We have so much to unpack, but let's take a step back. My understanding is you're not from Northeast PA. You're from a different corner of the Commonwealth. So give folks a little about your background and how you landed up there in Lackawanna County in the Cartwright headquarters.
So I am born and raised in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. So I'm a Pennsylvanian through and through. So growing up there, went to high school there, and then went to college at Temple University, which I'm sure even a lot of your listeners are probably a Temple grad. So go Owls. And then coming out of college, I graduated class of 2016, always was interested in this work and trying to obviously be part of progress. But that was right in the middle of Donald Trump running for the Republican nomination. It was just everyone remembers this, and I'm sure your listeners do, a harrowing time in our politics. And so I jumped on as Governor Wolf's call time manager in kind of his off-year operation. That was my first official job in politics. Got to learn a lot there and have the honor of serving the governor. And then after Donald Trump was elected, it just really crystallized for me that this was what I was going to be doing for the foreseeable future. I had to be part of this fight, and I wanted to do it at the federal level. So through how these things kind of work, I found myself out in California working for Congresswoman Julia Brownlee's reelection campaign in 2018. And 2018 was a great year for Democrats, right? So we took what at one time was a pretty competitive district, and she just blew it open, and we had the chance to go help members across the state of California, which played a pretty big role in us taking the majority in 2018. So I learned a lot there. And then I found myself, I was her finance director. Then I found myself working for Christy Smith after Katie Hill resigned her congressional seat, and I worked on that special election. On that capacity, I grew out of finance and was basically her communications director. My title was deputy campaign manager, but really, in reality, I was her communications director. That one didn't work out. And that was the first, and I think really, if I remember correctly, the sole big special election during the time of COVID. And so we lost that race, and what people thought was kind of a red herring event of like losing a district, a Biden, or it wasn't a Biden district, but a Clinton district at that time, the way that was set up ended up being a harbinger for kind of the very weird cycle of 2020 and kind of that split presidential slash congressional result where we lost seats in the House. So after that special election was over, I wanted to come home, found myself working for Eugene DePasquale in the PA-10. I was his deputy campaign manager. Eugene is probably familiar to all of your listeners. And honestly, one of, if not the best, I don't want to say the best, that might rankle some other people I've worked for, but definitely one of the best people I've ever worked for. And that one still causes me some sleepless nights. I think about that loss a lot. And then after that, was a communications director for the Speaker of the House of Virginia, took my turn in government, but I couldn't quite kick the campaign bug. And then this cycle, I managed the Bucks County Coordinated Campaign in 2021, then had the pleasure of helping Austin Davis through his primary to get the lieutenant governor nomination. So incredibly proud of what he's accomplished. And Austin is not only someone I worked for, but someone I count as a friend. And so, or lieutenant governor-elect Davis, which I'm very excited to say. And then after we won that primary, obviously he combined with the Shapiro ticket. And so, so I found myself working for Congressman Cartwright, which was tagged as one of, if not the most competitive districts in the country. So had the pleasure of working for him, got to know Northeastern PA really, really well, and got to pull out a victory.
This is incredible. This is a lot in the last 6.5 years since you graduated. And as I often think about, I owe my life to Temple University. My parents met there. So it is, I did not go there to be transparent. I'm just curious because I mean, it's a beautiful part of the world. I haven't intimately gotten familiar with it like you did, but that kind of exurbs of Los Angeles, what strikes you as the biggest difference in managing a campaign and being involved with the politics of Southern California versus Pennsylvania? Or do you think that kind of what's on the mind of voters in a given cycle is the same, regardless of what corner of the country they're in?
No, I think geography obviously makes a huge impact because of the things that voters are concerned about, right? I know that there's overarching issues, right? Nationally, healthcare, access to prescription drug cost, expensive prescription drugs and access to those prescription drugs at affordable price. Obviously, inflation now, right? That affects everyone everywhere. Not an issue back in 2019 when I was out in California, but obviously now affects everyone. But there are other things like access to water out in California, right? And droughts and wildfires. And like, that's just not, those are concerns for voters out in Southern California, right? That are not necessarily as do not affect voters in Northeastern Pennsylvania the same way. So definitely not a situation where voters are quote unquote the same everywhere. I think you take each district as a unique entity, right? And you're going to hear me say the word community a lot because it's what the Cartwright campaign was centered around. But yeah, I would say the daily life experience of someone in Santa Clarita, which is where the Christie Smith campaign operated out of, and the life experiences of someone in Scranton are incredibly different, right? And so I would say that, yes, they're significantly different.
But what about building out a fundraising plan, building out a proactive communication strategy? Are there similarities? I mean, even then with what you were doing in Richmond with Trailblazing House Speaker down there, because we're gonna pivot listeners into the granular of how the Cartwright race was won and going into, behind the scenes of the campaign headquarters. But so you're coming at this with just so many incredible life experiences all before the age of 30. So, but I don't know, I suppose maybe every race is completely different than the next.
Here's my approach. And I think this is not unique to me for how I think of races, right? And this kind of goes back to my background in political communication, right? You take the candidate and ideally your candidate is a reflection of the community you're running in. If they're not, you're gonna have a tough time. And I think we won our race partly because our opponent was not a reflection of the community that we were working in this cycle. when it comes to Jim Bognet. But you take your candidate and you try to build a campaign and a message that is authentic to them, right? You have your issues. You know what's important to voters. You obviously poll test, right? You see what the salient issues are, right? But if every campaign could be won by a poll, then Democrats could have said the word healthcare between the years of 2017 and 2020 and won everything, right? And that's not the case, right? It's not just plug and play what you get out of your poll, right? You take those issues and then you look at your candidate and you say, how does their life experience, right, and how they relate to the district and their personal credentials and their background allow them to speak most authentically to the issues that are most salient to voters, right? And so that is how all campaigns are both the same and different, right? And I think it's candidate-centered. And by being candidate-centered, you're also community-centered because, again, your candidate should be a reflection of the community you're working in. So that approach stays the same no matter where it is. So whether it's Eileen Fillercorn talking about being kind of one of her life experience as a mother and as a woman and someone of diversity, right? The first Jewish speaker, I think really relates to a lot of how Northern Virginia, like that looks like a lot of Northern Virginia, right? Which is where her district is in as a member of the House of Delegates, as a delegate. And then you build how she talks about issues around those issues, right? Or around that life experience, around that background. And that allows her to be an authentic communicator on those, on the things that voters care about. And then when it comes to Austin Davis, right? You've probably heard this, but he's the son of a union bus driver and a hairdresser, right? And so he talks about issues with great authenticity coming from that background, right? So when he talks about how inflation hurts families or how he's going to help working families, or he's going to be a fighter for the things that voters care about, he's talking about it. He's a very gifted communicator in his own right, but the small role I played was helping him talk about issues through that frame. Right. And then Congressman Cartwright, he needs no help communicating to his district from anybody. But if I played some small part, it's the fact that he is from that community. He married him and his wife, Marion, who's his wife. Marion is from there. He has been married to her for 34 years. They spent a bulk of that marriage out in Northeastern Pennsylvania. They raised their two sons out there, and they're ingrained in that community. Matt Cartwright lives in that community. He is a member of that community. And so when we were talking about issues in this congressional race, it was centered around him and the community and how they could trust him because he was one of them. He cared about what they cared about because he was one of them. And Jim Bognet could not care less because he was a DC lobbying executive who came back to the district in order to try to get a promotion into Congress. And he's the worst of politics and everything that district resents about politicians.
So we're definitely going to get into the fundraising component and the field component, and I'm sure some war stories. But let's stay in the comms side of things. I would fully agree with you. I mean, I think the congressman has been an advocate. He's been a representative in every sense of the term for the district and his constituents. But the media landscape since his first election over a decade ago, it's just changed. It's changed everywhere in every congressional district of the country. So, you know, to what extent is you're building a proactive communications plan? Certainly, he has a day job. He's a member of Congress, member of the Appropriations Committee. I mean, how are you getting out your message?
Yeah, so it's multi-pronged, right? I mean, we all talk about paid media, right? There's you buy TV ads, you buy digital ads, you pay for mail, right? But that's not enough, and that's far from not enough, right? You need something to anchor that in reality, right, for voters, or else voters will see through it. If you're just trying to buy a campaign, buy a persona, voters will see through that. So the campaign obviously didn't play a role in this, but his official side, his work through being a congressman, they get a ton of press, right, through his activity. So whether it's helping to bring a gas plant to Northeastern Pennsylvania, the Nacero plant, which played a central role in our communication, right, bringing back tens of millions of dollars specifically for police funding. Public safety was an issue that people think Democrats, there's a misconception that Democrats are on the defensive when it comes to public safety. I think one thing we did in our campaign was show that you can be actually on the offensive about public safety. And the congressman obviously had a body of work that that made that an authentic argument, bringing back millions of dollars for Northeastern Pennsylvania's police officers. I mean, in kind of a fitting dovetail, he brought back over $1 million in COPS grants, directly hiring more police officers for three communities in our district. And I think that was 2 weeks before Election Day.
So, sorry, I just want to, this is really good stuff to unpackage. So if we could just take a step back. So you alluded to Nocero, you alluded to gas. We're talking about Marcellus shale gas and really innovative technology. But if you could just tease that out, because it is somewhat rare when Democrats talk about energy, but it just give folks a little sense of what you're referring to, and then we'll get to the police officer component.
Yeah. So the congressman has been taking a leading role to bring a $6 billion shale gas to car gas plant to Northeastern Pennsylvania. It would be located in Luzerne County. And so so at a time when obviously like the main driver of inflation has been gas prices, right? And we really took that as a big proof point on our campaign for multiple reasons. One, it is something he's authentically doing to address the biggest issue on the minds of voters, right? Inflation was the driving issue in this election in a lot of ways. And so it spoke directly to that concern that he is working on that issue. Two, it's a Trump 2.9 district, right? So Donald Trump won that district over Joe Biden by 2.9%. And so if it's just going to be a D versus R thing, you lose that race if you're the Democrat, right? What made the Nocero plant a great proof point for the congressman's work is it went against people's idea of what a conventional Democrat would support, like you just said, right? So it ran against that. It went against the grain of that, saying that Matt Cartwright's not just a rubber stamp for a quote unquote liberal agenda, but rather he's an independent fighter, fighting for things that are particularly helpful for the people of his district and not beholden to some political ideology coming out of Washington. So
and then, to that point, because Democrats too often have been tagged as we're just defunding the police. I don't know how that began. I don't know why it persists, but it's so far from the truth. But we have a lot of listeners outside of Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'm just particularly thinking of the D.C. Metro area where it's, you know, the Fairfax County Police Department, as you know from your work in Northern Virginia, or the Montgomery County, Maryland Police Department. But it's just, I'm just trying to clarify for listeners, you could literally go 5 minutes down the road and be in a different municipality and they have a different police force. So I think if I'm understanding correctly, these are federal DOJ grants and big check presentations that the congressman in recent years has been able to secure.
Yeah. So the COPS grants were specifically DOJ grants that he secured. And then all of this stuff comes from, or most of this stuff comes from the appropriations packages that he's helped pass. So he is one of the 12, I think the term is one of the 12 cardinals of Congress, 12 cardinals, cardinals of appropriations. And he's very proud of the fact that he was able to chair a subcommittee on appropriations, get there, right? Because it just has allowed him to steer so many resources over the last 2 years to Northeastern Pennsylvania. So in just the last 2 years, if I'm doing my math correctly, he's driven about $80 million to Northeastern Pennsylvania. And that's an incredible sum of money that is having a real world impact and will have a real world impact to that community. And it's not just through the appropriation package, right? He's also voted for things like the infrastructure bill, right? And then obviously the all of the funding in the American Rescue Plan, right? That is going to municipal governments and them using that money for their various needs, right? So he has driven millions and millions of dollars to the district.
Okay, so, and there is a history in Northeast PA, I would argue more so than probably 430 other congressional districts with previous congressmen like Paul Kanjorski and Joe McDade and Senator Spector. It's just something that, I don't know, in Northeast PA, maybe constituents are used to these large check presentations and bringing home the bacon, so to speak. And they can have tremendous, I'm just completely transformational projects over the years. So since we're talking about money, I think we might as well pivot to campaign finance, which for better or worse is the mother's milk. And it's how, if I understand correctly, you started your political career. There's obviously the powers of incumbency, but there was a lot that was talked about this cycle about the Republicans not having as much in terms of their FEC reports, but these groups that would sweep in Congressional Leadership Fund and others. So as when you came on board, and if I'm understanding correctly, it would be Q2, Q3 of the 2022. So there was obviously there's money in the bank. He's a sitting incumbent. But just share with listeners to the extent you're comfortable a little of how you were looking at the finance plan as it stood? Did it have to be kind of recalibrated? You know, was it consultants? Was it full-time staff? How much was call time driving the schedule? I think listeners appreciate this granularity. So.
Yeah. So I came on in Q2, specifically right at the end of May. And so right in that last month of Q2, there's one name everybody on all your listeners should know when it comes to raising money in Matt Cartwright, and that's Blake Lee Wall, our finance director, who led a full-time staff of four finance staffers and then led a constellation of consultants along with that. She did a remarkable job. And I think she did a particularly remarkable job because the history of Congressman Cartwright's races is actually interesting here. So for a long time, Northeastern Pennsylvania was considered a Democratic stronghold, right? And then even after it swung to Trump in 2016, the congressman was still winning his races by double digits in a really incredible way. And so Republicans weren't even playing against him. In 2016, they didn't play for his opponent. 2018, his opponent was independently wealthy, but they didn't really play for him. And he won that race handily. And then in 2020, the congressman, he'd agree with me, was a beneficiary of polling error, actually. So, because I think everyone had rosy projections for Democrats across the country in their polling. And I think both committees totally missed the fact that the race was actually tight just because of the fundamentals. And so the congressman comes away with a 4-point win when I think, and if the committees knew that, you would have seen a lot more action. Right on both sides, especially on the super PAC side. So by the interesting about these on the congressional level with these candidates is that if you're in competitive races as an incumbent, you automatically have access to this national array of donors, right? You're put on something called Frontline by the DCCC, which is the most vulnerable incumbents, Democratic incumbents in the country. And by being a Frontline member, that is basically, even during call time, you pick up the phone, say I'm on Frontline, that's automatically a validating statement about I'm a very important race and I'm in a very competitive race and you should pay attention to me. People will even go to the DCCC website if you're a big, big donor and just kind of just run through who's on the list and donate accordingly, right? And the more cycles are in a Frontline district, obviously, the more that class of individuals, that donor class, gets to know you, right? And so you raise more and more money because your network increasingly grows and those relationships deepen. Because cycle over cycle, they're getting to know you. They're seeing your names on this list. You're calling them cycle over cycle, right? Basically competitiveness begets money, which then begets even more money, right? Cycle after cycle. The congressman really found himself it's funny, he went from not a target to the top target, right? In the country overnight, essentially, right? They see the 2020 election results and then the Republicans are like, all right, we're coming. And so Blakely, what our entire finance team did was, they took a member who is well known for a lot of different reasons, but not known for being in a competitive race, and introduced him to that donor class and ended up raising $5.9 million, which is roughly about $1.7 million more than he even raised in the 2020 cycle. And so without that extra $1.7 million, we would not have won re-election. The congressman would say the same thing, right? We needed every dollar that we raised. So one, that is incredible. And then two, when it comes to the finance plan, so I walk in and we have $2.3 million in the bank when I came in June. I will take no credit for this idea. This was the congressman's idea. And I mean that genuinely. He said, we're going to go up on TV in July. Like, we're going to start communicating to people. We have the cash advantage. Jim Bognet comes out of a competitive primary at that point and is essentially broke. And so he's not communicating for another month and a half at that point. So he doesn't get on TV until midway point of August. And so we have the money there gave us unfettered access and sole access of the airwaves for a month and a half. For starting July 5th, and we were on TV ever since July 5th, which is incredible. One,
just clarify for listeners, it's one media market, correct?
Or
just
Lake
County has its own, or you skipped the... Yeah,
that's a New York media market, and
that wouldn't even make sense.
It's about 9% of the district.
And then I know that radio, especially some of those morning call-in shows, are so important. Were you taking out radio ads at that point, or was that later on?
Oh, we did that later on. We didn't start off with radio, but we definitely had a heavy radio presence in the last 2 months of the race.
So then how much of this was the congressman or members of his family or the senior staff calling? Was it event heavy or was it just acquiring lists? And we all got those campaign emails and campaign text messages, give $5, the sky is falling. I mean, what would you say was the percentage when you look at what an incredible sum? I mean, close to $6 million, just hard money and just so.
Yeah, well, so here's the other thing. Northeastern Pennsylvania is not the richest part of the world, right? And so it's not like being in New York or the New York suburbs, right? It's not even...
It's not your home county of Montgomery.
It's not even being in the Philadelphia suburbs, which I was about to say, right? Where you can just have a really event, like you can also have a events heavy program. Obviously, we had events that was obviously we had supporters in the district who really stepped up and contributed to the congressman, of course, but someone like in a district like ours, it has to be a lot of call time, right? It has to be a lot of reaching out to people all over the country and raising it dollar by dollar, call by call, right? And that is so I would say an extremely heavy call time program. And then obviously we did have events, but it's not the same as being in like a very wealthy district where you can raise basically that $6 million from your district.
So one of those events, and then I think we should pivot to the field operations because we are talking about some really diverse territory. One of the events, and it's crazy, it was only a month ago. It probably seems like 6 months ago, but you had the president of the United States gave up a chunk of his evening and joined you all, albeit virtually. But maybe you could share a little of how that materialized when you first learned about that and then how, you know, even at that point, I'm sure many stones have been turned over, but how you go back to the well one more time and ask donors to step up and join your boss and join the president.
Yeah, I think that event was a product of the fact that Congressman Cartwright has been steadfast in the sense of supporting the president, right? And so there was a lot of talk about, quote unquote, running with Joe Biden, running against the president, right? And the congressman was always true to one thing, right? Is that he supports the president. He endorsed the president during the primary, right? And the president's from Northeastern Pennsylvania, and he's going to work with the president to bring the most amount back for Northeastern Pennsylvania. What we're going to do is make sure voters know that I care about Northeastern Pennsylvania above all other things, right? And regardless of who I support or don't support, they know that they are my number one concern when I'm in Washington, right? And so we never played the game of kind of running against or with anybody. We focused on the congressman's brand and who he is and communicating that to voters. And I think people appreciated that. And I think that I think the president gave us some of his time, and that was really crucial for us.
As we pivot to the field discussion, which I'm far from a field expert, but it actually, the first time I knocked doors for a campaign was Election Day 2006. I want to say in Jessup or somewhere up the line there. Anyhow, that's ages ago and neither here nor there. But President Trump came to the district, and I think it was kind of the kickoff rally of the fall season when field operations really begin. So why don't we start our field discussion with kind of what was going through your mind when you all learned that the arena was going to have a fairly loud, boisterous crowd.
Yeah. So if we're talking about Field and Cartwright, we got to talk about Kate Peterson, who was our organizing director. She built a organizing culture from scratch, right? Again, being in these competitive races mean that you are constantly running a field operation cycle over cycle. And that also builds muscle memory that allows the program to grow and become stronger over time. This district overnight went from a kind of afterthought on the national political playing field, right, to front and center. And I think Steve Bannon called it the epicenter of the battle for the House, right? And so she built something from scratch. When it comes to Donald Trump coming to Northeastern Pennsylvania, and I remember that day vividly, and I remember the run up to that day vividly. Look, we never ran for or against anybody. And this race was never going to be about Donald Trump or about Joe Biden. And Donald Trump remains fairly popular in the district, right? He is, we know that from our data. We know that from just being there on the ground, right? People in the district think that he speaks against this this a corruption and kind of an elitism present in Washington, right? And I don't need to expound on that much further. I mean, we've heard about this, as has been covered to exhaustion, about why people find President Trump attractive. So this was, when he came, it was never about him, right? We have from the start of the campaign, especially the general election, we came to the conclusion, right, that this was going to have to become a test of character between Jim Bognet, a former DC lobbying executive, or Matt Cartwright, someone that we knew from the jump, from our data and just from, again, being on the ground, that people implicitly trusted as someone who cares about them. And so this was going to become a character test of who do you identify with more and who do you trust more when they go to Washington. And the one thing I can tell you that whether you're a Trump voter or a Biden voter, what you don't like is a lobbying executive political hack who has spent his entire career seemingly plotting his political rise, right? Running to be your congressman. I think that in Trump language is called a swamp creature, right? And so our entire campaign was premised on, one, you trust Matt Cartwright. You like Matt Cartwright. He's delivered for you. Send him back to Washington. But also, Jim Bognet's everything you hate about politics, right? Jim Bognet's everything you hate about politics and politicians. He is slimy. He's going to sell you out, and he might say things you quote unquote agree with, right? Or you identify with, but you trust the messenger. And the answer ultimately was no, they didn't trust the messenger. They trusted Matt Cartwright, right? They trusted the person they saw fighting for them time and time again, and they weren't going to hand over the reins of the district to a creature of Washington.
I would just say, we highlighted it pre-election in a previous episode, but I think it's going to go down as one of the most clever ads of the cycle as we're looking at the World Cup. I don't know if they do gold, silver, bronze in the World Cup, but it's going to be somewhere on the medal stand of when you had a Trump voter with a red hat and a Biden voter with a blue shirt sitting on a park bench talking about Congressman Cartwright.
And I will tell you that
I just don't know of a single other campaign that did that this cycle. And it spoke to exactly in 30 seconds what you're talking about.
Well, one, it speaks to who the congressman is a person. Two, John Petrizzo, who's a Trump voter in that campaign, is Trump through and through. I mean, he voted for Doug Mastriano, Dr. Oz, and Matt Cartwright. And so he is the real deal. But I will also say that what I found really heartening in this campaign, one of the things I found very heartening in this campaign, is that him and I actually grew to be fairly close, and we really liked each other and we hit it off. And maybe that speaks to some larger point of maybe we're not as divided as people think we are. But yeah, we're especially proud of that ad that was made by our media consultant, David Brown, who does the congressman's TV ads. And it spoke again to the very core of our argument, which was that whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Biden voter, Trump voter, Matt Cartwright, you have a seat at Matt Cartwright's table, right? You are his concern, and he fights for you. And that was the message we really hit on the entire campaign.
Just because you alluded to two other campaigns, we don't have to dwell on whether or not the other side was coordinated, but I would be curious, go back with your GOTV operations, to what extent? I mean, was there a top-down Shapiro Davis, Fetterman? There was some hot statehouse races. Or were you building a program proactively and others kind of came to you? Or were these kind of trains on parallel tracks?
So at first you build your own programs, right? The coordinated structure gets built at the statewide level. But as a congressional campaign, we were always going to build our own program, right? Which if it then plugged into a larger coordinated campaign, was ready to do so, right? But 99% of the organizing work was done by Kate Peterson's organizing team, right? So she was the one who hired her staff. Like we had a staff of six field organizers, and she had a deputy. They recruited volunteers. Those volunteers were knocking doors for Congressman Cartwright, but we always had them knocking doors for the Shapiro Davis ticket, the Fetterman race, and for our state house races, right? We wanted to, the congressman's big on leading by example, and he's a proud Democrat. And so he was always going to support the races, both at the top of the ballot and down ballot. But in the last month or so, then you see an integration of all the campaigns across the state. And that's when it becomes a truly coordinated operation in every sense of the word. So that was about the last month of the operation and the last month of the cycle, where it fully integrates.
So we're talking about territory in some instances that's quite rural. In a lot of instances, there's a hell of a lot of hills.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as your team's looking at this, there's certain precincts. I mean, you mentioned Lackawanna for a reason. You led our discussion by saying when we saw the numbers coming out of Lackawanna County, but even that, I mean, is that driven by the city of Scranton, or were you getting into each and every township in the county? And then, you know,
yeah,
there's some very, very red counties that not very densely populated. I mean, I'm curious how deep. I mean, I don't think you were able to go to every single door in the district.
No, we did not get to every single door in the district, but we did knock on 61,000 of them.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot of raw knuckles. Okay.
So the incredible program that Kate built was really centered on, again, every part of our campaign was integrated on the fact that, one, he's fighting for Northeastern Pennsylvania, and he's fighting for every single member of Northeastern Pennsylvania. So the two counties that we knew we were going to lose were Wayne and Pike, right? Those are just two counties that are decidedly red, and we know we're not going to win a majority of the vote there. But the difference between losing it by 20 points and losing them by 25 points is a huge difference, right? And that's the margin of the race right there. So we made a concerted effort to organize in Wayne and Pike, knowing that we were going to lose, right? But we were going to get the most bang from our buck, right? We were going to reduce that margin of loss to the greatest extent possible. And what you ended up seeing was that we retained our 2020 numbers in both of those counties. Those counties could have been in a political environment like this, a place where we could have totally just had the bottom fall out, right? And if we had the bottom fall out, we would have lost this race. But we made a concerted effort to make sure we organized those two counties to the extent we could. And yes, they were rural. And yes, those packets looked like 15 doors over the course of 2.5 hours. Yeah, that was definitely the case sometimes. But it was incredibly important. You can't win Northeastern Pennsylvania just by trying to win in Lackawanna and trying to win a majority in Luzerne, right? You got to hold down your losses in Pike and Wayne. You got to win Monroe by a decided margin, right? And then you got to win Luzerne big, and you got to keep Luzerne competitive. And that is the roadmap in which we won this race. And that's a roadmap on how to win the 8th congressional district in Pennsylvania.
When I think of Pike and Wayne County in recent years, and I guess even going back, there's a lot of interplay with folks from New York and New Jersey who have lake houses or send their kids to summer camps. Where am I going with this? Did you have a lot of, you know, volunteers coming down I-80? We see this every cycle. There's out-of-state volunteers that just show up and say, put me to work. I'm ready to knock any doors or do whatever.
That was especially the case in the last month. We had buses come in knocking doors, and that was pretty amazing. My personal favorite is that we had a group of volunteers come from Hawaii and spent like 5 days in the district knocking doors right up to the run-up of the election.
I hope they bundled up a little bit different temperatures.
We had a pretty mild October and beginning of November in Northeastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, it's all relative compared to Oahu.
yeah, that's true. But it's good
stuff. Yeah. So just progressive folks who got on a plane because they wanted to do their part.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
And I will tell you, those doors are valuable, but just a morale boost to the staff of saying like, wow, people all over the country care about what we're trying to do here, right? And they have our backs. That's
we got listeners all over. I need to check the data if we have Hawaii listeners, yeah. but good stuff. Were there particular allied interest groups or local Democratic committees that stepped up?
Well, yeah, I mean, the committee structures in every county in our district were strong and really good partners. We were lucky to there's a political tradition in Northeastern Pennsylvania that people who have been there and experienced it are aware of, right? And it's not just like politics is not something that people just like know about or participate in. It's something people do. And there are families that are hyper involved. There are people unelected who this is their where they spend their free time, right? Like if they're not working, they're involved in local politics. And so that is just always was incredibly valuable, right? And even I think the average Northeastern Pennsylvanian is more educated about politics and what that means and how it affects them than maybe the average voter across the country. And that's pretty valuable when you're talking about the fact that like that your boss is a appropriation subcommittee chair, right? And is bringing back money from that money back to the district. When you talked about earlier how there's a kind of a lineage of effective members from Northeastern Pennsylvania, I think voters in that community implicitly know how valuable that is and how important it is to have a congressperson that's doing their job.
All right. So you've been really generous with your time. And I'm just curious, two different points as we wind down. So Luzerne County made some national news on Election Day. And I think there was thinking maybe this was going to go to litigation or it was going to be, you know, it was going to be quite the saga. The said to do, my understanding is they literally ran out of paper. But I'd be curious, you know, as you're sitting there in a ward room with your team and the Cartwright family, I mean, what's going through your mind when news breaks about that?
Well, that was early in the day. So I wasn't with the congressman or his family yet. I was with our senior staff, though. And we find out about that. And that's just kind of confusing, right? And it's kind of your worst fears, right? And you then hear about how they're extending voting until 10 p.m. And it's just like, oh, this is the election that will just never end, the cycle that will never end. But I will say that our team kept its cool, kept their heads, right? And I'm really proud of that. We had just like some really just real, I cannot speak to how great the quality of this team was. And it is something that I'm going to come away with and just be really proud of along with the win, right? For a very long time. But we immediately pivoted and made sure that when we found out that the county was going to extend voting until 10 p.m., that we were going to let as many people know that that voting was extended until 10 p.m. as possible, right? We're going to call every Democrat in our turnout universe, right? And make sure in Luzerne County and make sure they knew that they had another 2 hours to vote. And so so that was a quick pivot. I can tell you that there was a little bit of shock in Cartwright HQ when we got that news, but that quickly pivoted into, okay, how are we going to, one, how are we going to take action on this, right? And so so that is, that's, we sent, I don't know how many, we sent definitely thousands of texts and made thousands of phone calls in the period of about, I think, 3 hours.
All right. So let's end, if it's all right, on a personal note. It just seems to me that every cycle, there's more and more Indian Americans who get involved in politics. And I think that's incredible when diaspora communities raise their voice. And it's just what really distinguishes our democracy. But personally, what does this mean? And where do you, when you look at, you know, the community as a whole, both in Southeast Pennsylvania and then nationally, what do you attribute, you know, this just incredible meteoric growth in political activism?
Yeah, I have to say it's super, it means the world to me, right? So like I came to this work because of my background, right? So obviously I'm a person of color, but also my dad was a cashier at Burger King, and my mom worked in a factory. And so economic need was something that I grew up with.
And they immigrated here from India?
They immigrated here from India, yeah. And so that is something that I lived with and was front and center in my life, basically my entire life. So one, having the opportunity to run a campaign like this one with the background that I come from, right? Hopefully that just means that the next person that comes along gets their shot too, right? And other people interested in this work that look like me or have the background, a background like mine, see that it's possible, right? That they can also affect the policymaking process, right? And the political process that affects their daily lives, right? And then the other thing is with all these people who are in the space now, and I guess specifically Indian Americans in the space, obviously we had a legislative victory out in Western Pennsylvania that was huge and helped take back the state house. I think Neil Makija also runs a PAC that encourages Indian American involvement in the political process here in PA specifically. And that work's incredibly important. And then just on a broader level, people of color should have the opportunity to run Democratic political campaigns, right? And we're the base of the party, right? The most loyal voters of the party, yet woefully underrepresented at decision-making levels in the party. And that's something I personally take seriously. And hopefully, if I end up on the right side of a few more campaigns, it'll just mean that people will take chances on people that look a little bit different. And that means a lot.
Well, I'm not a betting man, but if I were a betting man, I think you are going to be on the right side of a 2024 race and for that matter, 26 and beyond. And yeah, this is great. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point your name's on the ballot. So thank you so much for giving your time. And as I said at the beginning, for being deep, deep in the trenches.
No, thank you so much for having me. And this was a complete pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too, at PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week.